incisive cornet phrases could only belong to Leon Bix Beiderbecke, legendary American jazz musician of the 1920s. His highly inventive improvisations with groups like this one, led by saxophonist Frankie Trumbar, have earned Bix a permanent place in jazz history. Bix's hometown was Davenport, Iowa, where he was born in 1903 into a comfortable middle-class family of German origin. By the age of seven, he was labeled a prodigy for his abilities at the piano. He turned to the cornet at 15, and after playing with high school and college bands, he graduated onto the professional jazz scene with various small groups, including Trumbar's. At the height of his power as a jazz musician, he joined the orchestra of Paul Whiteman, known in his day as the King of Jazz. Bix stayed with Whiteman only 2 years, but in that time, he recorded some of his best work. He left the band in 1929 when, sadly, his alcoholic habit got the better of him. He died in 1931 of pneumonia, compounded by drink. Artistic genius and an early death have always been a surefire guarantee of legendary status. Bix was no exception. The myths have clung to him as persistently as his followers have tried to emulate his playing. One of Bix's most ardent devotees today is Richard Sudhalter, American journalist and himself a cornetist in the Bix mold. For 15 years, Sudhalter has collected material about his hero for eventual publication in this book, a definitive biography called Bix, Man and Legend. During his researches, Sudhalter unearthed many of the original orchestrations used by Paul Whiteman as a member of the band. So that Whiteman's music could be heard again live after so many years of neglect, Sudhalter formed the New Paul Whiteman Orchestra, a group of English instrumentalists sympathetic to the popular styles of the 20s and 30s. These rehabilitated Whiteman scores reveal the enormous influence of Bix on the orchestra, and therefore on the way popular music was to develop during the next quarter of a century. To trace the main threads in Bix Beiderbecke's musical career, I talked to Richard Sudhalter in his London home.
When did Bix actually first hear jazz, and what was its impact on him?
As close as we can gather, it first happened when his brother came home from what they called then the Great War. The elder brother had been a soldier. He'd never gotten further than a base somewhere in the South. I forget where it was. But with his severance pay from the armed forces, he came home with a gramophone and a pile of records, one of which was Tiger Rag by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, which he duly played in the course of things at home, and which turned out to be the only record of the lot which interested his younger brother, sufficiently so that young Bix appropriated it, played it until it was white with wear. I remember tone arms in those days weighed, you know, 3 tons and had steel needles at the end, so a record didn't stand much of a chance of lasting long. But before you knew it, he'd come by an old cornet and was teaching himself elementary fingerings, and, you know, crouching there in front of the horn of the gramophone, just blasting away, you know.
What was the response of Bix's family to his taking up jazz?
His parents didn't want him involved in jazz. They didn't want him involved in professional music. No fit life for a gentleman. You've heard it before. And being second-generation Germans, both of them, and being very, very tuned in to the whole kind of German-Austrian romantic tradition, they didn't want to countenance the fact that their boy was becoming more and more involved in music played in brothels, in bars, on riverboats, in places where people of the other social orders, such as they were, gathered. And because of that, there was a lot of opposition.
What was the first band he formed?
Well, the first band was really an assembly of young musicians from around the Chicago area, some of them college boys. All of them fired with a love of music and wanting to play. Eventually, a job at a roadhouse in Ohio, near Cincinnati, afforded them the opportunity to get together as a band. They called themselves the Wolverine Orchestra of Chicago, which is a name that sprang from the fact that one of the staples of their repertoire at the beginning was Wolverine Blues, and they played it till the cows came home, you know, and finally somebody said, well, why don't you call yourselves the Wolverines? It's as good a name as any. They, as many of the early pioneer jazz groups, made their first records for the Jeanette label, which was a division of the Star Piano Company in Richmond, Indiana, and constituted really just a very, very primitive studio in a back room of the piano factory. It also was located next to a railroad track, and all the pulleys and gears and clanking bits of equipment and everything would grind to a sudden halt every time a train came by, because obviously, you know, the sound of the train would shake the building and shake the equipment and knock the styli out of the grooves and every other thing. And I suspect quite a few takes were spoiled. It was not electric recording. It was all done with, you know, with horns and diaphragms and all the things that accompanied recording back in those early days.
Is it one of those recordings that you've used in order to recreate the group that we're seeing in the studio?
We wanted to recreate less the group itself. The instrumentation of our little group is slightly different from that of the Wolverines. We use a bass sax instead of a tuba and so on. Then an approximation of the kind of sound the Wolverines got. We've chosen a tune called Big Boy, which is a pop tune of 1924. It was actually recorded not in Richmond, but at Jeanette's New York studio, which presumably was more modern and more jazzy and streamlined than the one in Indiana. Judging from the sound of the records, it was pretty much all of a piece. But in any case, I think Big Boy, while not an attempt to imitate the record in any way, should give you an overall idea of what that kind of band sounded like, especially with Bix piloting it.
Committed was Bix to that kind of unconstrained, freewheeling jazz that the Wolverines played? Was he intellectually committed to it?
In the early days, yes. I think as a young man of 20, 21, which he was at the time these records were made, all he really cared about was playing, having a good time, playing improvised music, it was really a very happy-go-lucky existence, you know, blue skies and wheat fields and or whatever grows out there in the Midwest, you know. A very abandoned feeling, which was not really Chicago and wasn't New York or any of the very popular pigeonholes in which jazz critics tend to view early jazz. It was just the way young musicians, white musicians in this case, played out in the Midwest, in Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Nebraska, Kansas.
Once Bix had moved to a wider musical environment like Chicago, how quickly did his fame spread?
Well, among musicians, very fast. People all over the states, Boston, you know, towns, cities, and far reaching as that, or California, and all of them, knew of him, knew there was somebody about who was worth listening to. And as soon as the Wolverines records became circulated widely, you had musicians, cornet players, trumpet players, all over the place trying to absorb what he was doing. The general public was another story. Even at the height of Bix's popularity and fame and success, I suppose you could say, musically, the general public at large didn't really know much about him. Because jazz was not considered an art music the way it is now. You know, it was really just one segment of popular music. There was one guy in every band who was the hot man. He stood up and played, you know, he got off, whatever the quaint phrase of the time was. But, you know, Bix was really very much an inside guy for musicians.
Did he have many offers of work? Was he specifically invited to join groups?
For a while, no, because one of the things that hampered him was the fact that he couldn't read very well at that point. I mean, he didn't really become a competent reader until he joined Paul Whiteman quite a while later. At the beginning, in fact, when he left the Wolverines, he went with Gene Goldcat's orchestra in late 24, and was immensely popular, especially with the jazz contingent in the band.
What kind of group was Gene Goldcat's?
Largely a kind of commercial dance band on the face of it, but with a very heavy saturation of jazz-influenced people. This was true, actually, even more when Bix finally joined the orchestra on a permanent basis in 1926, and by that time had in it all sorts of people, including the arranger Bill Challis, who immediately appreciated what Bix had to say and began to mold the orchestra's sound around it.
After the Gene Goldcat Orchestra, what was the next important step in Bix's career?
Well, in late October 1927, both he and Frankie Trumbar joined Paul Whiteman, who had been really after them for quite some time. It's perhaps worth noting about Whiteman at this point that the title King of Jazz was conferred on him. He didn't invent it. He was, above all else, a very canny, very shrewd businessman, an orchestra leader who knew taste, who knew the taste of his public, knew how to reach a lot of people, and I think above all recognized musical excellence when he saw it. And he always liked to keep a few jazz musicians in the band, and when Bix and Trumbar became free, as it were, you know, he went after them. He offered them good money, and finally they accepted and joined him at the end of October.
What proportion of the music played by the Whiteman Orchestra was jazz in whatever form, solo or group ensemble? What proportion was arranged?
I think you could probably say that jazz was one facet of a pretty kaleidoscopic musical output. I mean, Whiteman, as the biggest thing in show business at that time, and 30-piece orchestra and all the trappings, you know, had a number of audiences to please, and he was able to turn the trick of keeping everybody happy at the same time. So therefore, some part of every evening, whether a section or spread out all over the evening, was devoted to the efforts of, say, for example, Bix, Trumbar, the Dorsey brothers. Challis, by this time, was working for Whiteman as one of his staff arrangers. And the same thing, to an extent, happened that started to happen with Goldcat as well, that end of the Whiteman Orchestra's output concerned with jazz was fashioned after, modeled, shaped around Bix's way of playing the cornet. I mean, he was the touchstone for the entire thing, really. Changing fashions, and certainly a lot of the novelty material the Whiteman Orchestra played has fallen by the wayside. Those scores having to do with Bix and the jazz thing, I always felt were timeless, that they would sound good today as they must have sounded good in those days. And what a pity it was that the only thing we had, the only means we had for hearing them was records which, while not badly recorded, certainly were not representative of what one could do today. So, as part of last year's Camden Jazz Festival here in London, we handpicked a 28-piece orchestra out of the finest musicians available here in Britain, trying as closely as possible to approximate chair for chair, man for man, the kind of skills that Whiteman's musicians had.
There's an obviously enormous labor of love involved in resurrecting these old charts and bringing together all these musicians. What did it feel like when you first heard the sounds of this ensemble?
I'm not one to, you know, given overly overt displays of emotion, but it just knocked me. I almost fell off my chair. It was just, you know, the sound was big and warm and lush, and there it was, you know, and I have to admit that I was knocked out.
Thank you.
in bringing together the group of English musicians to reproduce the Whiteman Orchestra of the 20s, did you ask them to reproduce as well the solos of the various instrumentalists they were representing?
No, absolutely not. In fact, quite the contrary. Part and parcel of making this thing living music, rather than just another great hits of type project, you know, was the idea that where improvised solos were supposed to be taken, they would be taken as improvised solos. Obviously, in doing this, you've got to find soloists who are reasonably true to the general idiom in which the original music was played. I suppose my own task was the hardest of all, in that you can't help be aware of Bix, not only you know, the sound that he made, but the fact that, I mean, these arrangements were built around his musical personality. And so, sure, what I play is going to come out sounding very much in the Bix idiom, but I certainly hope that the fact that they're my notes and my figures and not his, and not an attempt to imitate his, is something that comes home to people who hear the band.
How about the vocals with the group?
Well, we're very fortunate in at least one particular, in that we have Chris Ellis, who, again, is a walking encyclopedia of music of the era, and has managed to absorb the period flavor without consciously trying to imitate Bing Crosby. Well, Taint Soul was a problem when Whiteman recorded it, because it begins with Bing Crosby, in that case, and here in this case with Chris Ellis, singing the first note right out of the blue. And at that time, they had a lot of trouble recording it. I think it took them something like 12 takes to get it and get it right. We did it in slightly fewer than that, mainly because somebody had the bright idea to come up with a tuning fork. And since it opens in the key of A, somebody just ponged a tuning fork with A. Chris heard the pitch and off we went.
Say, people, you should come to Arkansas. Meet a friend of mine, old Aunt Phoebe Long. She's known to everyone for miles around. She will help you when friends forsake you and troubles bear you down. For those who come her way are blessed when they hear her say, "Tain't so, honey, tain't so." Spoke to the Lord and the Lord said, "No, tain't so, honey, tain't so. Tain't so, honey, tain't so. Tomorrow will bring something good, I know, tain't so. I mean, it just ain't so. Makes no difference what your problem may be. Just look up, brother, and I'm sure you will see. Tain't so, honey, tain't so. Devil said yes, but the Lord said no. Tain't so, honey, tain't so."
Thank you.
Is there no conflict in your own mind between the kind of music that we've always associated with Bix, that's basically an improvising jazz musician, and the kind of relatively sentimental music, I think one could say, and certainly highly organized music of Whiteman? You never seem to conflict at all.
Not at all. You know, it's been said, I suppose, millions of times, and bears saying again, that there are only really two kinds of music, and that's good and bad. Unfortunately, alas, for the historians and the record collectors and the rest, jazz didn't develop isolated from or apart from vaudeville and music hall music and show business and business in general and entertainment in general. So as a result, I don't see that great a disparity between, let's say, a six-piece Dixieland combo playing at the Jazz Band Ball and, on the other hand, Bix sitting in the middle of Whiteman's brass section playing Dardanella. He's the same man. He's playing within a different frame of reference, a different context. But he is still playing with a basic integrity. I mean, bear in mind that contrary to being stifled and stunted and you know, otherwise restricted by the conditions under which he played with Whiteman, he viewed his membership of that orchestra as the, not only the pinnacle of his musical career, but of musical achievement in the popular music profession. He was surrounded by men who were the finest virtuosi of their day on their instruments.
There are two band numbers that we've not talked about yet. First of all, I Found a New Baby.
I Found a New Baby is another one of those arrangements which was not recorded during the 20s. I'm not quite sure why it wasn't recorded, because it was very short and would have fit very well within the structure of a 78 RPM record. It's arranged by Lenny Hayton and has, as a point of novelty really, a couple of things. First of all, it begins with Bix setting out the melody and all. And at the end, it has what we call a radio coda. After the thing kind of tapers off in a fade, obviously during the 20s, fades weren't in, so that the band comes whomping back with this fully scored, lush coda, which has nothing to do with the arrangement or the tune or anything, but just really says in brief, okay, folks, it's over now. And as such, it can give you a bit of a giggle.
Thank you.
Ain't No Sweet Man.
It's called There Ain't No Sweet Man That's Worth the Salt of My Tears. And besides being a good song, I mean, musicians like to play it. It's got interesting chords and a good melody. We also have the added bonus of a bit of extra scoring. You know, on the original recording, the Rhythm Boys had a bit of jiving behind Bing Crosby's vocal, you know, and rather than have that here, we took the part that they sang originally and gave it to the whole trombone section, who kind of constitute a four-man instrumental Rhythm Boys team. All in all, it's a good piece of work. It holds together well.
Tell him goodbye rather than have that man gonna lay her down and just die. Oh, broken-hearted misters, aggravated sisters, lend me your ears. There ain't no sweet man that's worth the salt of your tears.
Was interested in music with a capital M in a very wide sense, European music, things as he grew and you know, both grew as a musician and grew older, far less interested in jazz in the narrow sense of the word. And certainly his being with Whiteman brought out a lot of the other things within him, things interested in less in just playing hot choruses, as they were called then, and more in actually composing music for orchestras such as Whiteman's. He was by this time conversant with Stravinsky and Bartok and such people, and anxious to translate what he knew of the American experience into some kind of an amalgam with the European tradition, much in a sense as Gershwin had done. But Gershwin had the singular disadvantage of never having been a great performing instrumental jazz musician. So that, I mean, Bix might have, had he had the theoretical and technical means at his disposal, taken what Gershwin was trying to do yet a step further. And certainly, it's no accident that Bix, when asked by friends what he viewed as his outstanding recorded performance with Whiteman, unhesitatingly cited his having played the very long and very difficult cornet solo on the Whiteman Columbia recording of the Concerto in F, which is, if you play it now, still, in comparison to all of the performances of the thing, the most authentic and the most fitting reading of that solo, because it doesn't sound like a symphony trumpet player playing it. It sounds like a jazz man playing a line, a composed line, against an orchestral setting, which is what Gershwin had in mind.
Contention, I think, if I understand you properly, that Bix Beiderbecke's role in the Whiteman Orchestra was crucial, that it produced a combination of sounds that was highly individual and specific to a moment in time, and that it's not really being paralleled. Is there any one number that you think illustrates that?
I think so. I think you could very easily go back to the full band arrangement Bill Challis did of what had started life as a small combo Frankie Trumbauer recording of a tune called Singin' the Blues, which, as we all know now, is the record on which Bix played perhaps his finest recorded solo. It's a kind of jazz set piece. Everybody from Rex Stewart through Bobby Hackett and heaven knows who else has made a recording at some point or other paying tribute. Well, Challis's arrangement was, alas, too long to record. He added an extra chorus. But it's one of, well, it's my favorite of all the ones we played, because it takes the best of the small group thing, brings out the best of the Whiteman ensemble, leaves room for me, for Nossiter, and for John R.T. Davis to play solos, and ends in a lovely kind of all-in chorus. It's just a masterpiece. Thank you.